then let's develop our motivation and think that we'll listen and share together today so that we can learn some new skills to transform our mind, to free it from unwanted, disturbing emotions and to cultivate our good qualities. And to do this, not only so that our life can be better, but seeing that we're intricately involved with all other living beings, let's have the long-term wish to be of great benefit to all others by working on ourselves. And so have a feeling of your interrelationship with other living beings, how we rely on each other, depend on each other, how we have received so much kindness from others, and have a wish to repay that kindness. And to do that, we have to learn ways to decrease our disturbing emotions and increase our positive ones and set clear priorities that will make our life meaningful. So with that motivation, we'll share together today. So in the sharing the Dharma days, we've been going through, you know, it's like a series that we continue each month, but you can also come even if you haven't attended the previous ones. And it's been based on Don't Believe Everything You Think, which is a book that came out that I did, and it came out late last year. And so already, we've covered three topics already. Let's see. The first topic had to do with starting out on the path and got us to look at our precious human life, the way ignorance, anger, and attachment create problems for us, and how to calm our mind and simplify our lives. And then we also, the next chapter was about death and dealing with loss and setting priorities and distinguishing between good friends and bad friends on our spiritual path. And then turning to the three tools, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, for spiritual guidance. And so this chapter is called The Next Step. And
Verse
4, switch of plans. What else is new? Actually, the name of the verse is looking at death and dealing with loss, and it's about death and impermanence. So here is impermanence. You know, you thought you were talking on one topic and you're talking on another one. What to do? Okay, so this verse, okay, it's a beautiful one. It says, "A loved ones who have long kept company will part. Wealth created with difficulty will be left behind. Consciousness, the guest, will leave the guest house of the body. Let go of this life. This is the practice of bodhisattvas." So bodhisattvas are beings who have the altruistic intention to become fully awakened so they could be of the greatest benefit to all other living beings. Yeah. So this is one of their practices. And it's a topic, you know, talking about death and impermanence. is not the favorite topic in American culture. I don't know about you, but in my family, people didn't want to talk about it. They were afraid if you talk about death, it might happen. Implying that if you don't talk about it, you won't die. But that didn't make much sense. And near where I grew up, there was, off of the freeway, there was one of the first Forest Lawn cemeteries. You know, now they are, they have some new title, but they're kind of like parks, and you can go on a Sunday afternoon picnic there, and art galleries and different things at Forest Lawn. But anyway, at that time, it was strictly a cemetery. Anyway, when we would drive past it, because it was right off the freeway, I remember one time asking my parents, you know, kind of what was a cemetery, and they said it's a place where they put people who have died, and I said, what's death? And there was this long pause, and I got the feeling I wasn't supposed to answer that question. And then somebody said, you go to sleep for a long time. So, you know, as a kid, you know how you pick up things that aren't verbal? So I knew, there's something about this. And I watched as, you know, different people in my family died. I remember when my grandmother died, they didn't tell me at first, and I found out, and, you know, just how it was this hush-hush subject. And so, but for me, you know, I just felt like, but this is an important subject, because if we're going to die, that is going to influence how we live a lot. Yeah. And yet I couldn't find many people who were willing to talk about death. You know, people saw it as morbid and so on, just wanting to ignore it. And yet if it's the one thing that we have to do, then it seems wise to prepare for it. You know, we say, I have to do this and that, you know? I have to drive here, I have to go there, I have to submit this report. Actually, we don't have to do any of those things. Those things are all optional. You know, if you look at your mind and everything you tell yourself you have to do, you don't have to do any of those things. You're choosing to do them. The only thing we have to do where we don't have a choice is die sometime. That's the only thing. Everything else is optional. Okay? When you realize this, you realize you actually have a lot of freedom in your life. Okay? But since, you know, death is something that happens to all of us, it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter how much money you have, how much access to health care you have, it doesn't matter whether you're spiritually realized or not, or whether you're famous or not, death is the great equalizer in addition to aging and sickness, which are great equalizers, aren't they? You know, there's no difference among any of us in that regard. And you could die in a gutter, you can die in a luxury bed, but it really doesn't make any difference, does it, at the end of the day, because death is there. So, given that death is the one thing that we have to do, it really makes sense to think about it and prepare for it and bring an awareness of death into our life to make our life more vivid. Okay? So it's not a morbid topic. It's, you know, dying is not sinful, it's not a mistake, it's not unnatural, it's the thing that comes, you know, when you're born, then death comes, you know? It's quite a natural process. So the way people often add all sorts of stuff projected on death, really makes death a difficult topic for them, when it's a natural thing, you know? I mean, we see with the seasons, the plants are growing now, they age over the summer, they die in the autumn, and, you know, they're gone in the winter. It's, you know, it's not good, it's not bad, it's not this or that, it's just the way the natural cycle goes. Okay? So I was actually quite relieved when I encountered Buddhism, because it was willing to talk about these topics that most people in society don't want to talk about. Yeah? And for me, it's important to talk about these kinds of things. So it was quite a relief. It's like, oh, okay, we can talk about death now. We don't have to make it this big, hush-hush, secret, terrible thing that you have to protect children from thinking about, or you have to make up stuff to account for, or whatever. Okay, it's just a natural process. And so, given that we're going to die, then the question comes, what is the meaning of our life, and how do we give meaning to our life? And considering that we don't know death, when death will come, although it will, then what are our priorities? What is important for us to do in life, and what isn't important? Yeah. And considering that when we die, we can't take our body or our possessions or our status or our friends or relatives or anything else with us, then, you know, what is important to accumulate? Because at the time of death, only the karmic seeds, the imprints of the actions that we've done physically, verbally, and mentally, those are the only things that come with us when we die. Yeah? And those in our mental habits. So given that that's the situation, you know, what really is important? And so that's why this meditation is said to be an extremely important one for spiritual practice, no matter really what your religion is or what your spiritual practice is. Because if we don't think of our own transient nature, then we're just going to keep on living on automatic and not really think about how to have a good life here and now. Okay? So, you know, if we think about the fact that we're going to die, yeah, and that all the people we love and care for are going to die, you know, it's really a rather sobering thought, you know, because we see that the things that mean a lot to us are impermanent, are transient in nature, that they're not always going to be there. And so given that, what is our relationship with them? What is a healthy relationship with them? Okay. So in terms of people, well, let's start it this way, okay? When you hear some people die completely relaxed and at ease, and for other people there's a lot of fear at the time of death, okay? So the people who have fear at the time of death, usually it's because they don't know what's going to happen next and because they have unfinished business in their life. Yeah? So what kind of unfinished business do we have that we would like to finish and clear up before we die? Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of dying with regrets, I never heard of anybody saying at the time of death, I should have worked more overtime. Yeah? Never heard anybody regret that they, you know, they should have, I really should have worked more overtime and gotten more money. Yeah. never heard anybody regret that. What are the kinds of things people usually regret at death? Yeah, they usually have to do with their relationships with other people, you know, or their ethical conduct. Or to put the two together, their ethical conduct in relationship with other people. Okay. And so that entails, you know, if we're going to die free of that kind of regret, that entails getting in touch with what we're feeling and freeing ourselves especially from anger and any kind of regrets we have in relationship to other people. Okay? And that entails apologizing to people who we feel we have harmed and forgiving people who have harmed us. Yeah, don't you think? Do you want to die with holding grudges against people? Or do you want them to die with you holding grudges against them? So this is an important topic, I think, really, for us to look at. And, you know, to look at who do I need to apologize to? Now, have I harmed somebody maybe because of jealousy or because of anger or because of greed? You know, I did actions that were damaging to somebody else, and I regret having harmed them, and I regret from my own side, from the viewpoint of my own self-respect and my own integrity, I regret having let myself do something that wasn't quite right. Yeah? And so having that regret, and instead of carrying it around with us our entire life, which is why I think many people get bent over when they get old because they're carrying so much regret on their back, you know, figuratively, I think it comes out that way, you know, to keep on top of our lives, and when there's a situation we regret, to apologize. Sooner rather than later, because we don't know when we're going to die. Yeah. Now, of course, there's some people who may have died already who we can't apologize to directly, but we can, you know, write them a letter, you know, from our... 'cause the important thing is for us to get in touch with our regret and our wish not to do that again, and our wish to really change. Yeah? So even if the other person isn't alive, so we can't apologize to them directly, or even if they're alive but they're not ready to talk with us yet, still, from in our own heart, the important thing is to frankly and truthfully acknowledge to ourselves. Or if you're a Buddhist, you acknowledge in the presence of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha our mistakes, and then to do some purification. There's a whole purification practice we do in Tibet Buddhism. And then that way we, you know, we free ourselves from that kind of remorse or guilt or whatever it is. And if we, you know, choose to go to the person and apologize, well and good. Like I said, it may not be possible to apologize to them directly, and that's fine. The important thing is that inside of ourselves we've made peace with the situation and acknowledged our role in it. And when we can do this, then mentally and spiritually we are so much lighter. Yeah? So, you know, it's one thing to make mistakes, because we all do that. But given that we all do that, the important thing is to make amends and to purify in one way or another. That's what's really important. Okay? And this idea we often have in Western culture of feeling guilty and torturing ourselves for our wrongdoings, as if, you know, the worse I make myself feel, that means the more I'm atoning for what I did to somebody else. Do you think that's true? Do you think making yourself feel lousy through guilt and beating up on yourself mentally has any productive value? You know, does it really amend for somebody else's hurt feelings that arose due to our actions? No, it doesn't help the other person at all. Yeah. So we want to give up guilt because from a Buddhist viewpoint, guilt is an affliction. An attitude that keeps us imprisoned. So we're not encouraging guilt here. We're encouraging responsibility. Hmm? They're very different, aren't they? And so apologizing. And then forgiving simply means releasing our anger. Doesn't mean what the other person did was okay. It means that we're not going to be angry about it anymore because we realize that being angry ourselves and holding a grudge ourselves only harms ourselves. Yeah. So rather than hold on to anger, we release that anger and forgive others. Like I said, it doesn't mean what they did was okay. But releasing the anger and forgiving them helps us heal. Because otherwise we wind up carrying around anger for years and decades, don't we? Feeling that I can't be free from it until the other person apologizes. And that's ridiculous. Why does our being happy depend on somebody else apologizing? That's giving up our power and saying somebody else has power over me because I can't be happy until they acknowledge how miserable I've been. No, why not be happy now? Okay, so apologizing and forgiving are things that are very important to clear up in our life so that we can have good relationships with people right now while we're alive. And then when we die, we just go. You know? There's none of this, oh, I should have told so-and-so this, I should have said this and that to the other person. Because we keep on top of things day by day by day. Yeah, we don't let regrets and bad feelings build up. But we clarify them every day. Yeah. And then we're happier now and also happier when the time of death arrives. Hmm? Another practice that's good to do to prepare for death is to practice generosity, giving our stuff away. Now, we've been talking about this a lot in the Abbey community. I've been doing a series of talks. Somehow the topic of death has come up in like everything we're reading now. Yeah, there it is. But, often during our life we use our possessions and our money as a sign or a symbol of our success in life. Yeah, and that's what society says. If you have money, if you have prestige, you're successful. From a Buddhist viewpoint, money and prestige have nothing to do with having a successful or a happy life. Zero. Yeah, really zero. Because we see people with a lot of money and with a lot of prestige who are totally miserable. Don't we? Yeah. Look at Hollywood stars. Everybody looks, oh, Hollywood stars. Would you want to live the life of one of the Hollywood stars? Or would you want to live the life of one of these famous sports heroes that everybody idolizes? You make $1 million for hitting a ball? That's what it is, isn't it? You know, they pay $1 million to hit a ball. or $1 million to throw a ball. yeah. But, you know, when you think of the kind of lives they live, would you want to trade places with them? Yeah. Most of them do not have happy family lives. And plus, their family lives are written up in People magazine. Would you want the intimate details of your life in People magazine? Yeah? Would you want people at their office talking about your life? They didn't know you, but they think they know you because they've read all these gossip columns. Did you hear so-and-so, this and this and this and this, you know, making up all sorts of hypotheses, taking sides in your, you know, custody battle, you know, your whole life on the tabloids. Yeah? Would you really want that? Yeah? Or would you want to be one of these Fortune, is it 500 or 400? Fortune 500? I thought it was Indianapolis 500. Anyway, one of these big money magnet, you know, types that, you know, are you sure it's 500 or 400? What's the name of the magazine? Fortune
500.
Fortune 500, okay.
So, Fortune is correct.
Huh? So, yeah, so Fortune, this magazine. Yeah, would you rather be one of the people that's written up in there? You know? I mean, think about it. We look at these guys and we go, wow, they're rich. Wow, they're so smart. Wow, they're written up in magazines. Everybody knows their name. Would you really want that? Think about it. I think it really confines you when you become that famous and that rich. You really lose a lot of your flexibility in your life. Yeah. I did a memorial service once at Bill Gates' estate because his best friend died. And I left and I, you know, there was this sense of, wow, you know, Bill and Melinda, they do wonderful things with their money, but they're also imprisoned by it. You know, their kids can't go on the street and play with other kids. Could you imagine what would happen if Bill's kid's child was kidnapped? Ooh, the ransom would be, you know, incredible. And I just realized, you know, I can walk down the street, nobody knows who I am, nobody comes up to me, you know, with their opinions about how I made my money and what I should do with it. Nobody comes up and asks for my autograph. I can just walk down the street and be nobody. And that's real freedom, you know. And Bill Gates can't do that. These Fortune 500 guys, you know, can't do that. The life is so confined, especially by other people's expectations. You know, you've got to have a certain kind of car and be married to a certain kind of person who looks in a certain kind of way and live in a certain kind of house. And, you know, there's a lot of social pressure and not so much freedom. Yeah. So, you know, think of who you're jealous of and then ask yourself if you would really want to change places with them or not. Okay. But my purpose in talking about that is you might have all the wealth and reputation while you're alive, but when you die, does it matter? Yeah. When you die, who are you going to say, but please call my secretary, you don't have an appointment? I'm not going to die today. Yeah. All your wealth. You know, sorry, I can pay you off. You want $1 million or $2 to keep me from dying? How is that going to help? Who are you going to pay off? Who are you going to ask out to dinner? Yeah. Doesn't matter. None of that matters. When it's our time to die, we die. So, you know, that kind of attachment to status, to wealth, it doesn't matter beans. Doesn't matter beans. And you know what I was just saying about rich people? Look at powerful people too. Look what happened after Margaret Thatcher died. Yeah? After you die, do you want people singing Ding Dong, the Wicked Witch is Dead? This is what some people were doing in Britain. Yeah? They were selling out on this Wizard of Oz song. Remember that? Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead? Some people were singing that after Margaret Thatcher died. Do you want people singing that after you died? You might have had tremendous power when you're alive. Yeah? But it doesn't matter. Anyway, after we die, it doesn't matter what they sing. Yeah? And it doesn't matter what they say about us, because we aren't even here. We aren't even here. Yeah? I mean, just imagine if your relatives forgot to put you in the obituary column. You wouldn't even know it. Yeah? If they forgot to mention all your good qualities in the obituary column. Hey, we've been married, 67 years, and you forgot to say this about me in the obit column? You know? We aren't even going to be around. Doesn't matter what they say. One time I was with four of my Chinese friends. We were on pilgrimage in mainland China. They were from mainland China. And we were having tea in this, little Thai shop in the middle of nowhere. And there was a picture of the Gang of Four on the walls. It was kind of a leftover, I guess. They hadn't realized they were supposed to take it down. But there was a picture of them up. And one of my friends commented to me, here are people who had great fame and great power. And now, where have they been reborn? Yeah? They had a lot of power. They're responsible for the misery and death of a great number of people. Where are they born right now? What are they experiencing right now? So even Mao Zedong or Ronald Reagan, or it doesn't matter what great leaders, you die, but what comes with you is the seeds of the actions that you've done. And if you've had hatred, if you've intentionally caused harm to others, then the seeds of those actions, the seeds of the thoughts, even if you weren't the person who made other people kill or whatever, still, because you ordered it, the seeds of all that killing comes with you on your mind stream. In Buddhism, there are heavenly realms and hell realms. All of them are within the, within cyclic existence, and our aim is to get ourselves out of cyclic existence. Yeah, but they don't have a special hell realm for politically important people, where you can hobnob together. Yeah, as your bodies are freezing or burning. You know? So are you getting what I mean about how thinking about death makes us ask ourselves what is a meaningful life and what's important to do in life? Yeah? Because if those kind of results come after this lifetime, you know, not because anybody is rewarding or punishing us, but simply because when you plant rose seeds, roses grow. When you plant chilies, chilies grow. It's not a system of reward and punishment. Yeah, there's nobody external to us to appeal to. Yeah, but when we see that things arise dependently due to causes and conditions, then we kind of wake up and realize, oh, I experience the result of the actions I do, so I need to be attentive to the actions I do and take care with what I do. Because my actions not only influence others, they influence me. Yeah. And so this kind of awareness makes us much more attentive, makes our life much more vivid. It makes us really think about things before we do them and really pay attention to what we're doing in life. And also to pay attention to why we're doing whatever we're doing. Yeah. And when you think about it, how much do we actually pay attention in our lives and how much do we just operate on automatic? You know, everybody watches this TV program, so I do. Everybody, you know, upgrades their computer, so I do. Everybody does this, so I do. Everybody says that success means X, Y, and Z, so I try and be successful according to their standards. Yeah. So we just adopt the conditioning around us without even thinking in our own hearts, is this true? Is it sane? Is it worthwhile? Yeah. And so we just kind of live our lives on automatic, not really aware of what we're doing and why we're doing it. And very often, just having the thought in our mind of, you know, I don't know why I'm alive. I don't know what's the meaning of my life. It doesn't really matter because after I'm dead, I'm dead. So who cares? So I might as well have a good time and do everything I want now. You know, might as well live it up now and enjoy because when I'm dead, there's nothing afterwards. Yeah. And so then we run around trying to do all these things thinking that we're going to enjoy them. But how much satisfaction do we actually get from running around over-consuming? Which is the trademark of our country. You know, we 5% of the world population and we use 30% of the world's resources. And does it really make us happy? We run around doing all these things. Does it really make us happy? If those things really made us happy, why are we here this morning? You know, isn't there something in our awareness that says, you know, there's something deeper going on in life. There's something more important than running from one cruise ship to another or, you know, one whatever it is that we enjoy doing to another. And so we came here to kind of investigate and think about what that could be. But when we think about death, then that, you know, puts these questions right in front of us. And it makes us think, and it makes us choose, and to choose using wisdom instead of just operating on automatic. Yeah? And so it's interesting how thinking about our own mortality gives us more choice in life. Because we see we have choice. When we live on automatic, and just let societal conditioning tell us who we're supposed to be and what we're supposed to do, then we've actually given up our choice. So, you know, thinking about our death, thinking about just the fact that we're going to age, is very helpful in waking us up and making us think. Yeah, so that's why I say it's not a morbid topic at all. Not at all morbid. We're all in the same boat, aren't we? Unless somebody here has some special guarantee they're not going to get old and die. Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah, but it's something really to think about. So let me see, in the book, you know, I commented on the verse, and then I included some people's stories. So let me see whose stories are in here. Okay, well, there's two stories, so let me read them to you. The first one is a child's innocence about death. Because what I did is I gathered people's stories to illustrate these verses. Okay, so let me read the verse to you again, and then I'll read a couple of stories. So loved ones who have long kept company will part. Actually, let me say some more about that one. Given that loved ones who have long kept company will part, what's the use of fighting each other? What's the use in families of competing with each other, of quarreling, of blaming, of yelling and screaming inside families if we're going to separate? Doesn't make much sense, does it? Doesn't make much sense. Okay, when loved ones who have long kept company will part, wealth created with difficulty will be left behind. Consciousness, the guest, will leave the guest house of the body. Let go of this life. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. When it says let go of this life, it means let go of being attached to the things of this life. So let go of your attachment to your possessions. Enjoy them when they're there. Don't overconsume. Create some good karma by giving them away. Yeah? And do it without being attached. Okay? So let go of this life means without this clinging, without this compulsion. Yeah? So I've got to have the utmost happiness all the time with everything I do. Let go of that. Just let ourselves be content. Okay, so the first story is a child's innocence about death. My first exposure to death was at age 12 when my 90-year-old great-grandmother, who was the rock of my family, died. When my parents told me she was dying, I didn't know what that meant. At age 12. We went to her house and everyone was crying. Do you remember your first exposure to death? And you know how the adults around you acted and how you learned what you were supposed to do and feel? When I went into her room, it looked like she was taking a nap. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't understand what death meant. Whatever death was, the adults around me were acting differently than I'd ever seen them act before. Having some time by myself to be in her room, I realized that my great-grandma was gone. When I asked the adults, does this happen to all of us? They replied, yes. I was horrified to learn that we have to let go of the guest house of this body. Letting go of attachment to this life is quite a task. The fact that we have to do it is a powerful reminder to reflect on an important question. What does life mean? Okay? From a Buddhist viewpoint, yeah, we would say our life has great meaning because especially with a precious human life, we can get ourselves out of the cycle of existence that is propelled by ignorance And we can develop our love and compassion for other living beings and even attain full awakening and then really work for the benefit of other living beings and for the benefit of society as a whole. And so in that way our life actually has great meaning and purpose. Okay, here's another one called the dress rehearsal of letting go. Last year I gave up a wonderful husband of 11 years, a house I had owned and lived in for 20 years, and a community of friends in the city I had lived in for 37 years in order to come to Srivasti Abbey to support Venerable Thupten Trudren's vision and to support the Dharma friends who wanted to become monastics. At that time, I had followed Venerable Thupten's retreats and teachings for 14 years. A few years before moving to the Abbey, I noticed my interest was waning in vacations, nice restaurants, the latest movies or novels, and conversations about the constant political ups and downs. At one time, my husband enthusiastically suggested, "Let's go on a trip to Costa Rica." When I felt absolutely no wish to go, I knew I had to change. Shortly thereafter, I told him that I'd rather go to the Abbey. Although my life in the city was comfortable and fairly happy, and I had good long-term friends and an interesting part-time consulting job, I had hit some kind of ceiling and simply could no longer spend time and money pursuing the small comforts that we all shared. For those of you who knew Zopa at the Abbey, this is her story. Over the next year, although I did not become a monastic, it was amazing to step away from the householder's life. As I shed the house, car, bicycle, skis, books, furniture, clothes, and pets, I felt calmer and happier. It was strange, as there were two separate voices inside me. One saying, "Yes, I am finally pursuing a true path to deeper wisdom and compassion." And the other saying, "How in the world can I leave everybody I love and all those who love me?" Now I've been living at the Abbey for almost 4 years. She lived here longer, and then a few months ago she left to do a year-long retreat, and then she plans to come back. Now I've been living at the Abbey for almost 4 years, and I see that most pleasures of cyclic existence really hold no lasting happiness. My understanding of impermanence and my upcoming death have deepened. I am glad that I had this rehearsal of letting go, of being able to give things away in order to practice for the moment when death arrives. Okay. So a little bit of time if people have questions or comments on what I've said. Yeah.
How would you define success?
How would I define success? I would define success as mental peace, as generating as much wisdom as we can, as much impartial love and compassion as we can, as accumulating good karma or merit. And in the process of doing all of that, I think you have much more happiness now as well as at the time of death and in future lives. Yeah. So I would define, also involving having the genuine wish to be a benefit to others. Yeah. Certainly not all the junk that we accumulate. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Yeah?
I knew that the contact with your family, and your family did not react at all to your trying to speak about death and permanence. What did you do? What is an alternative to bring our relatives or whoever we are close to point that this topic is important, or is it only through our own behavior that what you told, sometimes we have to be a good symbol adult, having a good example for living an ethical life. Mm-hmm. So, do you have any more suggestions?
Yeah, so how, with our family, to help them have an awareness of death and thus the importance of living an ethical life. You know, it really depends so much on the receptivity of your family. My family doesn't want to think about these things. Now, my mom died a few years ago. My dad is 92 in 3 weeks, a little over 3 weeks, he'll be 92. And you can tell he's thinking about death, but he doesn't want to think about death and he doesn't want to talk about death. And, you know, there's not much... If people are not receptive, there's not a lot you can do to get them to talk about death. You can help them to talk about, you know, the value of living ethical life and do that separately from talking about mortality, you know, and just the value that comes from, you know, having a generous heart and an ethical life in terms of feeling free of guilt and shame and regret in this life and feeling comfortable with ourselves when we go to bed at night. So, you know, those kind of points you can make to people without bringing up the topic of death if they're skittish about death. Yeah. That answer your question okay?
Yes.
Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
I haven't totally formulated my question but correctly, but sometimes I get confused about how to negotiate a relationship with relatives, you know, especially thinking about my dad who's so sick, and how to feel like, you know, how to feel like I'm supporting him, but at the same time knowing that I can't be with him all the time. And, yeah, I guess maybe how to cultivate an expansive quality that my practice is benefiting others when sometimes it feels like, you know, kind of small.
Okay. So his dad is quite sick, so he's asking that in that kind of context. And so wanting to support your dad, yet also knowing your practice is beneficial, but sometimes your practice feeling very small in comparison to maybe the help, the practical help that you could give your dad.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And so how to work with that. I think it really is you know, a personal choice and something for you to look at inside and to see how much does your dad need help, and what kind of help does he need, what kind of help does he want. Does he want help? I mean, he needs physical help with things. Is he okay accepting that kind of help from people who are strangers? Would he prefer to have it from family members? My dad, I think, prefers to have it from people who aren't family members. Yeah, so some people are like that, and some people prefer family members or people they know well to be the people who help. So to see, you know, what, in terms of the physical, practical things, what he needs help with and if he would even want that. And then to think also on a spiritual, mental level, what, you know, what are his wishes? Is he seeking to talk about these kind of important issues or not? And if he's seeking to talk about them, are they something that it would be more important for you to be there to talk with him about it? Or could you talk about it over the phone or by visiting from time to time? Mm-hmm. Yeah. In terms of your present practice feeling small in comparison to the big help on a physical level that you possibly could give to your dad if he wanted that, use that in terms of saying, then I've got to really practice well now. mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, make my practice go up a notch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and then dedicate that for your father. Yeah? But also looking and seeing if there's some important things you could learn from helping your father, and also asking yourself, how are you going to feel after he dies? Will you wish that you would have gone and helped him? Would you wish you would have visited more frequently? What kind of is in your heart, you know? Okay, so checking what he needs, checking what you need.
Mm-hmm. Given that, at least in the U.S. or a lot of families that I've seen, death is swept under the rug. Many children don't have any exposure to death. Not only do parents not talk about it, but it's just their child doesn't have any exposure to it.
Yeah.
So realizing when we become adults that intellectually, yes, people die. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with it emotionally?
Mm. You mean when you grew up as a child who was not educated about death when you were a kid, and then as you grow older you're confronted with it. How do you deal with your total not having been exposed or knowing anything about death? I think you come to classes like this, where people are willing to talk about it. Yeah, you have to go with people who are willing to talk about death.
But what? How does that comfort you?
I think, how does talking about death comfort you?
How is what is being said here comfort you?
You mean when other people die?
Yes.
Okay, so you're asking how is what we're learning here comfort you when you have to deal with other people's death and the loss in your life? Okay. First of all, I think realizing that death is just a natural event. You may not have learned a lot as a kid about death, but you get just the message of it doesn't exist and don't talk about it. Makes it seem like something bad, something... What?
Failure.
Yeah, some people even associate death with failure. Or punishment in, you know, some religions and religious families see death as a punishment. So there may be all this kind of inkling, you know, or thoughts in the back of our mind that we've never even recognized that we've had. And so just hearing that death is a natural process that everybody goes through can be very grounding. Yeah? And then thinking, we didn't talk so much about it today, but in other times, thinking about the continuity of consciousness, you know, that the body is like a guest house and our consciousness is something that inhabits this body temporarily, but we are not our body and the mind stream is going to leave. Yeah, and so thinking about past and future lives, thinking about the fact that there's no fixed personality, that can be comforting in many ways when you have a big picture. Yeah. When our mind has very strong attachment and it's saying, but I don't want this person to die, I don't want separation, I refuse to accept it, that attitude causes so much pain because it's fighting the reality of the situation, which is that everything changes momentarily and that, you know, things are governed by causes and conditions and we can't control everything in our lives. So just hearing somebody talk about the fact of how our mind can very obstinately and stubbornly fight reality and how fighting reality causes misery, can, you know, help us say, oh, but, you know, loss is part of the human condition. Yeah? And so I might as well learn to accept loss gracefully, because there's going to be a lot of loss, because there's going to be a lot of change. And if I can learn to handle it gracefully, then when I'm together with people, I really make the relationships vivid, and I don't bother getting angry, you know. And when it comes time to die, I send them on with my love and my prayers, you know, and with a clear heart, knowing that while we were alive, I encouraged this person to live an ethical life, to be generous, to, you know, develop fortitude and not give way to their anger. So I have no regrets in terms of, you know, what seeds I nurtured in this person's consciousness while we were together. And so I can send them on with my love and good wishes.
So my dad is, I feel like the earth element is going with him, you know,
mm-hmm.
and he's not talking so much. Like when I talk to him on the phone, it's really kind of being monologue lately.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't talk much. But when he has talked about death a number of times, but he mostly talks about how old the people are that live where he's at. He's mostly talking about, you know, life. You know, and I think he's quite fearful.
Yeah.
And what's hard for me in bringing up the topic that I actually think I can is I have kind of a qualm when because I think so much from our world view, I almost don't know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
He's very, relies a lot. He never went to church. I can't remember until he retired at 73. But he has a very spiritual side, and he relies on God. He actually said to me once in the last couple of years, I just don't know how you could get through a day, you know, without having this God somehow. I don't know what it does. So I'd like to talk to him about this, but I have a fear in the back of my mind of I don't know how to support his worldview. Exactly, you know.
Okay.
But I know that it's very beneficial for him, and I love that. And it's not like I need him to change or anything. I actually just am not sure how to. I wouldn't know what exactly to say.
Okay. So because your worldview.
I'm gonna take care of you. No, I can't quite see myself saying that.
Yeah. So your worldview and your dad's worldview is different, and so how can you talk about death and give him a space, because you're not. I mean, it's gonna. It will require you kind of holding your own worldview, but stepping into his worldview. It's like learning another language. You know, when you learn a second language, you have to learn a different way of thinking. Yeah, and so okay, while I'm talking with him, I'm talking in his language.
I'll maybe just ask him to tell me what he's.
Yeah.
You know,
what do you think about death? Or do you have concerns about death? I mean, it sounds like he would be open to some conversation. Yeah. And then just listen to what he says and talk using the concepts and vocabulary that he does.
Mm-hmm.
Unless maybe he asks you, well, what do you think? And then you could tell him. But otherwise, you know. Like whoever you talk with, you have to learn their language.
Mm-hmm. One of the challenges I have is allowing myself to have that continual death and rebirth on a daily basis, on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tendency to cling or grasp to so that neurons that fire together, wire together, that sense of a permanence, ego. Especially around the area of failures.
Mm-hmm.
And that letting that pass away just as easily.
Yeah. Okay. So when we cling on to our failures, kind of from one day to the next, and create a self-image of, look at all the messes I've made. Yeah? And how to let that go. Yeah? To realize that, you know, whatever unethical actions we did, we can do purification practices. Those things are not rigid and permanent. Whatever mistakes we made, you know, again, we can do purification. And those mistakes are not happening right now. They're not continuing right now. Yeah. So it's the whole idea that everything's changing from moment to moment, whether we want it to or not. So let it go when it's changing. Don't carry the past with you, because what happened in the past is not happening now. Okay? So we do what we can to repair, but especially the purification practices are very helpful, because in that way we learn from our past actions. And by learning from our mistakes, then that really helps us in our life to not do them again and again. So we're going to stop now. Oh, we've gone quite a bit over time. There's a potluck lunch, so everybody please come, whether you've brought something or not. And then after lunch, there's a discussion that will be based on some of the topics and where people can really, you know, kind of open up and talk about this, you know, in a more personal way. So, well, there's some dedication verses on page 30 in the blue book. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore.